Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, one of my favorite organizations in town, the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. I noticed they're doing some really interesting and creative things with their visual culture these days. And, it sort of kind of came to my attention when they were doing, what was it, Dean, the show with the two wonderful artists that
we just... Aquion, yeah. Lurie Bygon and David Ellis.
Yes, yes.
Is known for his, in the Rock and Roll Album Cover Hall of Fame as a young man. He did all of the album covers for Fleetwood Mac and Counting Crows and Sparks. And his work was definitely not what we would usually program here. And then he was up with David Ellis, who has been photographing Point Lobos for decades, the rocks up there.
I loved speaking with them. And then, you know, your staff was kind enough to give me a tour of the show. And it was just an incredible, but it marked for me like a new era in how the museum is looking at what maritime art really is.
Sure.
And And so, you know, the idea of maritime art, well, is it associated with the water? Yeah. But it also, you know, now with Susan, and we're going to talk about this, is Susan Reed Cronin's new show that's opening at the museum. The idea is that August 13th through November 29th, we're going to see not necessarily maritime as we would think of it as traditionally, but one of the things that I think is important to think about in terms of our history is the medium. And so we have the Susan working, she's a bronze sculptor. And so we have the idea of bronze being a super important medium in terms of sea and seafaring. And that, it wasn't lost on me, Dean. It was like, okay, this is really cool because we have, not only is it just, so as traditionally we look, okay, well, is the image of the sea in the work? So is it a two-dimensional work? Is the ocean in there? We got waves in there. Well, okay, that's one way of looking at maritime art. The other way is, okay, what's the history of ships and shipbuilding? And, you know, that's always been a huge through line in maritime art, you know, and the idea I call it the Canton School, where, you know, in the 18th century, Chinese artists would come out and paint the beautiful schooners that were coming into Canton and give them to the American and the English captains. So there's a whole line of that. That's maritime art because it's of ships. But we have a different thing here in that Susan is a bronze sculptor, and we don't necessarily think of the kind of things that she's doing as classical maritime, but at the same token, why does it have to be? It doesn't. It could actually be about the medium, and it could be, you know, maritime bronze is important in tools and in trade and in navigational instruments. We couldn't have actually done the work we've done on the oceans, you know, over the years without bronze tools and ship fittings and bronze instruments and, of course, diving equipment in bronze, propellers and all the underwater equipment. You know, bronze is a very solid, the salt content in the sea doesn't disturb it the way other metals are disturbed. So bronze is a super important thing. You know, we talk about the growth of the ship, seafaring in the Bronze Age, for example, also. So, you know, this is a cool thing to talk about as an artist who's devoted her life to bronze. And I don't know if people can, Susan, I wonder if you'd spend a few minutes. I don't know if people, especially, you know, when I do a lecture on bronze lost wax casting and how bronzes are actually made, people don't necessarily understand how that process is made and how complex it is. And I guess what I want you to talk about, first of all, let's talk about the medium, how it's made, Susan, if you would be so kind. And then I'd also like to talk about how you create in bronze, because I've always been fascinated by artists that can actually sculpt in bronze, because to be an artist in bronze, you have to think in two ways. You have to think negative and positive space at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's not always possible. It's a specific skill set. Likewise, if you talk about etchings, you have to talk about how an artist that's doing the etchings is seeing what the line is versus what the line isn't. And it's a real hard thing to do, it can't be taught. Well, it can be. It can be perfected through teaching, but it certainly is a gift. And dear listener, you'll understand more what I'm talking about when Susan starts to talk about how bronzes are made. So, Susan, talk about the lost wax process.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you so much for hosting me on your show. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, heck yeah.
I hope you'll have a chance. Since it's pretty freshly up, I hope you'll have a chance to go and see the show, because part of the show is this educational component describing exactly what you're asking. And I was given a grant to write a book to explain the bronze process to 600 third graders. As you might know, bronze casting is a very complicated, long, many, many step process. And so to simplify it down to as simple as possible was quite one of my, biggest achievements in my life, because it really took a lot of thinking about how to simplify it down. And so there are, I almost would just say, just go and see the show, because it's all outlined there for you. There's panels on the wall and there's little didactics that people can look at to see how the process works. And I've had people actually see this and say, you know, I was an art major, or I'm in the art museum trade, and I had no idea how bronzes were made. And I started that way myself. I thought, oh, you just take your model and you just dip it in a bucket of bronze, like a peanut M&M, you know, you dipped in the chocolate and then you're all set. That's all you have to do. That's really how I thought it was made. And then I realized, well, what happens when you want to make more than one? You're kind of in trouble there, because obviously you already have whatever you made was inside that bronze now, and you're screwed. So, so then I realized I better find out more about this. And it turns out that I was completely wrong about how to make a bronze. And I actually start.
When you say completely wrong, what do you mean you were completely wrong?
Well, I was thinking about those baby booties that people would dip in some kind of formula,
right.
And they come out and they're bronze, you know? So I thought, well, maybe that's how they do it. They just dip it into some kind of electrolyte bath, and then all these things stick to it and you're all set. But then I realized, when I went to visit a foundry and I saw the process, I thought, oh boy, there's a little bit of a learning curve here. So I don't know how far you want me to get into this, Elizabeth, because we could go on for about an hour. But
yeah, so if you give me the 7 essential steps.
Okay. Well, I would say I start with a clay model.
And clay then model, number one. Okay.
Clay model, yes. I take it to the foundry, and they will make a mold of that, a rubber mold. It's as if I want to make more than one, which I always do. I make an addition. They'll make a rubber mold of it, and rubber mold is covered in plaster to help it hold its shape. Then they'll open it up. They'll take out my clay model. They'll close it back up. They pour in hot wax. They let it cool. They open it back up. They take out
into what? They pour hot wax into what?
Into the mold. Into the empty mold.
Into the rubber mold.
Yes. But we've taken where the clay model, they made the mold of the model. They opened it up. We took the clay out. We closed it back up. Now it's empty. So you're talking about, you know, that idea that there's nothing there, and then you're pouring in hot wax. Now, let's just say an acorn. Now there's a wax acorn in there. Okay, then you open it up. Now I have a wax acorn. And now I take the wax acorn and I make sure it doesn't have any air bubbles and seams and whatnot. Fix it all up. And then they'll, at the foundry, attach a plumbing system to the wax acorn. Okay, because that's going to be where they're going to pour the bronze into another mold that's made. So then we take the wax acorn that has the plumbing system on it, and you dip it in something called colloidal silica. And you probably dip it 30 times, depending how long it takes to get a nice thick shell. It's called the shell. It's called a ceramic shell. And in between each coating, when you dip it, you have to let it dry completely. So once that's all done, and you have a nice thick shell around your wax acorn with a plumbing system, you put that upside down in a hot kiln that's about 2,000 degrees. And underneath the kiln has a hole in the bottom, and underneath is a an empty drum that catches the wax. So you put it in upside down, the wax melts out of the mold and into the drum, and now it's very, very hot. I'm shortening it up a little bit. You'll take it out of the mold, turn it upside down, so now you have your pouring cup on the top, and you get the hot, you have heated your bronze in a crucible to over 2,000 degrees, and you pour that into the empty mold where the wax was now evacuated from. The bronze goes in there, and then that sets up and cools for a while, and then you take a bronze hammer and break off the ceramic shell outside, revealing inside, like I guess the chocolate bunnies, you know, inside there is something, maybe it's not hollow, you'll have your bronze acorn. And it has the plumbing system still attached to it, so it needs to go through a whole session of metal chasing and cutting off the bronze plumbing that was attached to it, and then cleaning it all up, bead blasting it, and then heating it up and applying a patina and then wax, and then you're finally finished. And that's the short version, so.
Yeah, right. And so so for, say, one creation.
Yes.
You're spending a good, well, obviously, once you've created it.
Yeah, once I've created it and I take it to the foundry, it's about 3 months.
3 months, okay. And people wonder why bronze work can be expensive. Well, there's the answer.
Yeah, and there's a lot of labor involved in each step, too, so, yeah.
And what? So another question that people are going to ask is, why is your foundry important?
I always say that bronze casting is a team sport.
Yeah.
And that is because my work is going to be just as good as the foundry that I go to. And if I go to really, and I have gone to wonderful foundries, and the relationship with the foundry people is important for the artist, because they'll be working on my pieces all along the way. And as I develop a relationship with them, they start to know what it is that I'm looking for, what's important to me. And also a lot of them are actual artisans in their own right. They're just not doing their own work. They're doing work for me in a way that's just, I'm so grateful to them, because if it weren't for them, my work would not look as good as it does. You know, not that I'm bragging that it looks great, but they are a really important part of how it's going to look at the end.
Traditionally, throughout the ages, a foundry has been super important to the artist. I'm thinking of the Roman bronze work and the work of Remington. They have adopted their foundry, and the foundry is their foundry, you know. The relationship is super important. And so, as you know, as an appraiser, Susan, I'm looking to see, well, where's the foundry mark here? Because if it's not their foundry, it's not going to be the kind of value that we're expecting at all. Mm-hmm. So that's important to realize that it's, when you're looking at Susan's work, you're looking at a lot of different skill sets that go in, you know, and almost down to the cotton socks of chemistry and physics. You know, there's a lot of different skill sets that go into the creation. So, Susan, so tell me why. I mean, this show is play, and it's bronze sculptures and other stuff. So, the importance of play, you get into a little bit in your press materials, but I'd like to hear from you. How does that fit into your oeuvre?
Well, I just think whenever I'm doing my work, I am playing. I just feel like this is something comes through me, and I'm always surprised by sometimes what comes out, and the idea that I am basically just playing and tapping into a creative juice that is sort of lying around the universe, and somehow it just I'm able to grab it and use it as my creative muse, I guess. And playing is, when I watch little kids play and the imagination that's involved, and there's just something about it that just speaks to my heart, that when I'm doing my work, is it really work? Because I'm enjoying it so much, and people enjoy playing, and I don't know if we take as much time as we'd like to play these days. So I want to encourage everyone to follow in my footsteps and look at things as playing. You know, you can play with so many things, and you'll see in the show, you can play with words, and you can play with multiples, and playing with scale and playing with perspective. And when I start playing with things and asking questions about, oh, well, what's going to happen, and having a curiosity, which I think is part of play, is like, you know, oh, what's going to happen if we do this or if we do that? And playing around with ideas. And so we probably use the word play quite a bit in our vernacular, but actually doing play is what I like to do best. And I hope that my work exudes that when you look at it.
Okay, so the idea of play. So what's interesting is that you include, I mean, so this is how my mind was going, and I'm wondering if I can put it in the form of a question. But it's been so interesting for me throughout the years to look at figurative bronzes, especially when they contain the human form, that they stand alone in the history of art because they become a focal point. And I give you as a defense of that supposition, all of the Civil War Confederate generals in figural form that have been, I mean, this is a piece of bronze, but for some reason, the figure of this particular human in bronze becomes a lightning rod. I mean, literally. And it has been throughout many campuses and town squares, you know, bronzes have been pulled down. And I laugh at that sometimes, although it's a cynical laugh, Susan, because it's like, okay, why is this? It's just like, okay, here's a smattering of something made of oil and linseed and da-da-da on a piece of textile. How is that? You know, it's the same thing. It's the medium. An oil painting is an oil on a piece of fabric. Now, when I get upset at the Civil War, for example, the generals in the Civil War, I don't rip down the canvas. But in terms of the bronzes, because it's a human figure, it becomes so much more accessible to understanding the human condition. And I wondered if you've ever, I mean, what made me think of that was you in your own flesh and blood, you know, standing on a little plinth, part of your diorama there. What I'm talking about is a picture that comes along with the press materials for Susan's show, in that she, as the artist, is standing on one foot, the back foot is kind of cocked, and she's standing on a plinth, and she's mimicking some of the figures that she's got that are also bronzes, you know, on the wall and on the tables all around her. And it made me think of the idea of the human form in bronze and how, I mean, if you want to attack somebody's religion, you go and pull down their bronzes of their major gods. I mean, you're not necessarily pulling down the nice two-dimensional drawings. Yeah, you're pulling down the human, yeah. And I wonder if you would reflect on that.
Well, it's interesting. I every year for about six, I don't know, maybe about 8 or 9 years, I would go up to the Vermont Studio Center, which is an artist residency, and I would do a month-long residency. And one year I was there, and it was when we had Saddam Hussein had been toppled over.
Yeah, and his bronze had been
right. And
over.
So we were watching it on TV with all these artists, and we're sitting there watching this on TV, and everyone's going, yeah, and they had all these ropes around, and they're pulling the statue down. And then when it fell over, all the art, you know, the other artists in the room watching this with me said, oh my God, it's hollow inside. He didn't even get what he paid for. And I thought that is really funny, because actually most people don't know that these large sculptures are actually cast hollow inside. There's a different technique to do that. And so they were saying like he didn't even get his value when he had his sculpture made of him because it wasn't solid bronze. And I just thought, you know, what we think of and what is actually the process. But it was interesting because people were cheering when they brought that down. And I think the difference between when you were saying a painting, it's just oil and linseed oil and canvas, and the actual sculptures is that the sculpture's in your own space. You know, the paintings are two-dimensional and they're on your peripheral, they're on the wall. And the wall doesn't come in to affect you, you know, personally, where there's an actual looming figure of some sort. So I think that's sometimes actually people aren't attracted to sculpture necessarily as buyers to have in their homes because they don't know what to do with it. They're not sure if something that's in their space, a three-dimensional object that they actually have to either wrestle with or think about. And so it's kind of interesting to see, you know, the whole symbols of the human form in three dimensions. Some people are just like, don't know what to do with it.
And what do you think? Is that a personality issue? I mean, you're saying, so I was at a house yesterday and the collector collected Fernando Botero, you know, the guy who,
yes,
Latin American sculptor who made very, very wide, big, you know, massive human forms. And he had one right on the kind of coffee table in the center of the room. He had one in the major dining table in the center of the dining area. And yeah, it commanded the space.
Yeah.
So, so this idea of a person that can take it, that can take that kind of intrusive sculptural presence versus those that, as you say.
Yeah, I've sold, I have quite a few galleries and they carry sculpture. Not all galleries have sculpture in them. They a lot of times just have the two-dimensional work.
Totally.
And the ones that have had the sculpture in it, one of them said to me, she said, you know, sculpture buyers are 10% of our market.
Yeah.
And she said, and I can tell when they come in because they immediately go to the sculpture. She said, that's 10% of the people. And I thought, that's really interesting. Because, and she said, it's really quite remarkable that you can tell, but they're really drawn to it in a way very different than most people that are just looking at the paintings.
So, yeah. And I think, you know, basically it's interesting. So people that like form, you know, this is a big deal for some people that like form. I have a collector myself, Susan, who he purchases only sculpture made of wood, you know, and so this is a big deal but they're three dimensional. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the important thing about this. Okay, Richard's giving us a sign we got to go to quick break. I want to, when we get back from break, Dean Noble, who's a director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, is with us today, and he was been listening in, and I've been watching his face. He was kind of laughing about poor old Sudan, who's saying that his bronze got toppled over, poor guy, and, you know, this sort of thing. And so I want to hear what he has to think about the show. So this is, we're actually talking with the artist Susan Reed Cronin and her show at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. It's called Play, Bronze Sculptures and Other Stuff. And, you know, basically, this is a real departure for me that's been so interested in the Maritime Museum and the visual world that they present, that they're kind of branching out into different ideas of what art means in the maritime community. And I love that. I love that it's so exploratory these days, Dean. And I'm really loving that. So when we get back, let's talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on that. Hey, Richard, go to a quick break. Okay. Mm-hmm. Don't turn that dial. Back with Susan Reed Cronin, artist, and her show, Bronze Sculptures and Other Stuff. Play is the theme. And we're also talking with Dean Noble, who is director of Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. Don't turn back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. We're talking with an artist that's showing right now, well, August 13th through November 29th at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. The Maritime Museum is presenting Play by Susan Reed Cronin, Bronze Sculptures and Other Stuff. And the exhibition connects bronze's enduring role in maritime history with contemporary sculpture, storytelling, and imagination. And I'm interested to know, I mean, my own self, Dean, and with me also is executive director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, Dean Noble. And since Dean has assumed the helm, there's been a real change, I think, in the definition of maritime art and how it is presented. even so far as I've noticed, there's a change in some of the permanent things that are in the gallery. And I'm wondering how that came about, Dean, and what was the impetus from the change from traditional to a real more, a much more expansive view?
Sure. No, I mean, I really need to give our curator, Emily Falk, credit for pushing us into new directions. But what's fun for me is by engaging in different artists to find different ways to tell stories. You know, the show we did with Larry Vigon and David Ellis was a big hit, and now Larry is working on us. He had done a video as part of his presentation, and we said, well, could we see more videos from you? So he's working with some collaborators from Los Angeles to come up and do some stories about the animals of the Channel Islands that will be running in our Munger Theater. The fun story that we've uncovered with Susie, as you mentioned, is, you know, bronze, they call, and its cousin brass, but to a lesser extent, bronze is really the ultimate maritime metal. You know, it doesn't rust, and ocean creatures and algae don't affix to it. Very sturdy, but it can be very malleable once it's melted, and it's in our diving helmets and our nautical instruments, and the two great big cannon we have upstairs in the second floor are brass as well. And I asked Susie, I mean, were they done in sand, or were they done in wax, or how did they manufacture those enormous cannons? And maybe, Susan, we need to commission some cannon from you, you know, just in case pirates decide to come back to the...
That's good. We have that little pirate mouse that's, you know, haunting the place right now.
Peg Leg.
Say that again, Susan. Say that again.
There's a sculpture called Peg Leg that's a mouse that has a sword and a hook for a hand and a peg for a leg. And he's in the show. So we were talking about he might like migrate around the museum, but I don't know. We'll have to see.
He's very popular and new to the exhibit. So yeah, come on down, folks. We're right here on the harbor. The view is absolutely stunning. You can get some of the best coffee in town right out here on our patio, and then go sailing or rent the paddleboard. We're eager to see you and show off this wonderful new exhibit.
So a question for Susan, the relationship between poetry and what you do.
Ah, that's the other 10%, Elizabeth. 10% of book buyers buy poetry. So I'm in the 10% of, you know, sort of, I guess, a very valued section of artists and writers. But I love to write poetry. And what I'm trying to do in my work is distill it down to the basics, to really, I think, to have things be understandable and approachable in the same way I feel my work, my sculpture, is understandable and approachable, and you can take it at different levels, that everything has a dark side and a light side to it. And then sometimes it's just silly and a lot of fun. So there are some poems in the show, and I actually had one person tell me at the opening that they read that I loved, I was saying that there's a poem about the artist, and one of the lines was, she loves avocados. And I had a woman come up to me and say, you know, when I was little, I loved avocados so much. And when somebody asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said, an avocado. So just the fact that people can read the poems that are there, and then they'll bring a friend over to read it together. There's one called How to Be a 3-Year-Old. And again, that's my sense of play. Like, we know, what do 3-year-olds do? And then how many people resonated with that and said, you know, I used to do that. I used to do everything except I did not put underwear on my head. So, but they had like...
that was my first husband.
So anyway, when I write my poems, it's, you know, in my work on my sculptural work, I try to work with composition and gesture and silhouette and distilling things down. You know, you'll know it's an elephant because it has ears and a long trunk. But if you said, you know, that is not really a National Geographic elephant, but you know it's an elephant. The same way with my poetry, I feel like I get certain significators in there where people can resonate with, like, okay, what she's talking about is this topic, and they can understand it without having everything like laid out for them and spelled out completely. So I have a wonderful mentor, Laurent Bosselaar, who was our poet laureate here in Santa Barbara a couple of years ago. And her favorite, one of my favorite phrases that she has is trust the reader, you know, trust the reader to understand what you're talking about. And not everyone's going to get it. But for those people that do, I'm going to trust them that I don't have to, like, you know, lay it all out completely.
So I just an interesting question. So, you know, I've always wanted to ask a sculptor this question. But you know how some people have like they're devoted to a talisman of some kind. So they carry around something. I think Richard had a coin that he carried around for like, do you still have that coin, Richard? Like for 20 odd years, something like that. I remember seeing it a number of times. And so it's something of metal that he carries around that he's loved. What is it, Richard?
It was actually a coin I got from Ireland. It was interesting. It wasn't a euro or a, you know, it was a sterling pound. That was it, an Irish sterling pound, because that was their, you know, one of the coins they used before they became a member of the EU. And it just, it meant so much to me because of, obviously, as you know, Elizabeth and our listeners, my love for Ireland.
Right. So that was a metal talisman that you carried, and that was it's a three-dimensional thing. Do you still have it?
I have it somewhere around here. I don't carry it in my pocket anymore. Now, my neck, I have because it doesn't work real well, my wife's the same way with our wedding rings. I've got my wedding ring on a chain. I have this turquoise and silver little talisman that we got when we were in Arizona visiting at Christmas time. And then my, what's called a vach. It's a Vedic astrology talisman with numbers and letters and so forth that's supposed to be there for a form of protection. So I carry around now.
So that's, I was going to ask Susan, so is there, you know, and I think of, for example, some of the forms that, you know, I treasure, not necessarily of metal or anything like that as far as medium is concerned, but the actual form. So, you know, a form, for example, growing up Catholic, for example, so we had maybe a form of the Virgin that's in every bedroom, for example. You know, so there's these forms that people have that they're, you know, they're human forms, and they're three dimensional forms that they treasure. And as an appraiser, it's really interesting when I go into someone's estate and, you know, the person's passed away and they're like, well, okay, you know, they've got these incredible pieces, for example, but then mom was devoted to this little insignificant thing that she treasured all her life that was on her dresser, let's say. And I'm wondering, as a sculptor, do you have such a thing in your life?
Well, I'm just bringing to mind my magic eight ball, which I really love.
Magic eight ball?
Yeah, I use it a lot. I turn it, you know, it actually helps me make some decisions about my work. And I've actually have two now. I have one upstairs and one downstairs. And I carry it around sometimes in my pocketbook. It's a little bit big for that, but I have to get it, you know. It's not a duffel bag, but a carry bag. It's not a bowling bag, but it's a bag.
Okay, and so you wait a minute. So now tell me that again. So you've got an eight ball, magic eight ball, and it's the one where you turn and you can see in the windows.
Yeah. It says, ask again later, you know. Yes,
right, okay. And you carry that in a bowling ball bag?
No, I said my bag is not a bowling ball bag because it's not quite that big and it's not quite that heavy. But I do have I usually can carry it in a bag. And when I have to go out to dinner, sometimes I'll bring it with me, you know, we'll help with the menu. So it's a lot of fun. And I enjoy that. I mean, I like to look at it for some reason. It just reminds me of when I was like 10. We had the poo-poo cushions and the eight ball and the Ouija board and sort of those iconic things growing up in the 60s. I don't know when they first came out with the eight ball, but.
Right.
Something I really love. It's yeah.
Well, that is interesting. Dean, how about you? Do you have like a talisman of something, like a form thing that you love?
Oh, thank you for asking. No, I can't say that I do, but you know, in some ways you could say a museum is a
the whole museum.
So I have plenty of reflective stuff close by. And I would say my favorite is probably the Fresnel lens here. It's a lighthouse lens that was installed at Point Conception in 1853. Just an extraordinary work of industrial art. And it lit Point Conception for 140 years. Really remarkable.
Yes, definitely. And So that was just a thought, is it, if there's like a special. And then I guess what kind of, Richard's giving us a sign we have to close up pretty soon, but I'm wondering, go to break? Okay, so let's go to quick break. I was going to ask Susan, do you find in your work that there's themes? Are you now approaching, you're shaking your head, yes. Is there an era happening for you? I'm wondering about that.
Are we taking a break, or do you want to know the answer now?
Yeah, let's take a quick break, and we get back. I want to know what feels like an era closing and opening right now for you. Okay, don't turn that down. Back in a minute. We're talking with Susan Reed Cronin and the show at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, presenting play, bronze sculptures, and other stuff by Susan. And Dean Noble is with us, the executive director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, who is setting down in firm tones the importance of bronze, Susan's medium, to the world of maritime history. And I think that's so cool that we're focusing on the medium as part of the exploration the museum is working on right now. Okay, Richard, go to quick break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with the executive director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, Dean Noble, and he is proud to present the artist Susan Reed Cronin, Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, presenting play, bronze sculptures, and other stuff. It opened August the 13th. It's going to be going on till the end of November of this year. And I wondered if Susan would talk to us about, in the creative life of an artist, if there's a feeling that one era is coming to a fruition close or is gaining hold of another era, and what that might feel like.
Before she answers that question, Elizabeth, okay. I'd like to know if you carry around some kind of a metal talisman.
Oh, right. Yeah. Basically the stuff that's, that I have a wood sculpture that has part of my mom's ashes. That kind of thing where it's highly symbolic. So the shape of the wood and the artist who did the wood was a great friend of my mom's. And basically I see that every morning, that kind of thing. So it's a form, it's a container. A form is a container.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of some kind. Yeah.
So Susie, what era are we entering?
Yeah.
Wow, I'd have to think about naming it. But I would like to just talk about something about my themes, because that was sort of related to this a little bit. And as you do,
yes.
Doing this for about 30 plus years, you start to see things emerge and things keep coming back. I went through my elephant phase where I just had tons of elephants coming out. I'd be trying to make a rabbit. Next thing I know, it turned into an elephant. And then I had a phase where all of a sudden there were ladders that kept showing up, or there were matches that kept coming into my work, and things would kind of grow. And then I say there's another piece that has matches in it. And I didn't realize that I actually had a matches theme until I looked at the body of work. So looking back on it, it's kind of fun to look back on it and say, what is all this emerging here? And what are the things that I keep going back to look at and keep coming up again for me? But I want to say that during COVID, since it was kind of difficult to get to the foundry and people weren't really getting out to galleries to buy things or look at things because of the shutdown, I decided to really focus on my poetry. So in a way, my phase now is playing with words more so than playing with creating new sculptures. So I'm saying I'm also playing with scale. So I'm taking pieces that I have created and I'm making them a little bigger or even bigger. And the biggest piece right now is a ladder that is exactly my height. And maybe about 20 years ago, I was working with a good friend of mine who was a wonderful sculptor, Walter Mattia, asking him how to help me, if he could help me enlarge a piece. And I had brought this rabbit down to his studio in Maryland. And I made it. And by the time I finished the clay model, I said, this thing is scary. It's too big. It's confronting me. I don't like it. I need to keep small. I need to keep my world contained where I can be in.
Yes.
Effort.
Yes.
But then, you know, now I'm playing with scale in terms of what does it look like when it gets bigger and feeling much more comfortable with that. So I'd say maybe that's my new phase, is making things bigger.
Well, I think that's so interesting because we're talking about the idea of the human form in sculpture. And I'm thinking of like the early, obviously there was bronzes, but I mean, thinking maybe the stone sculpture in ancient Egypt. So you had your smaller kings. They were actually physically smaller sculptures. And your big pharaohs were big, big, big sculptures. So scale made a huge impact on the idea of form. Okay, so I'm a small god or a small sculpture. I'm a small, you know, smaller king, and I'm not so big, but I'm Tutankhamun and I'm huge, for example. So, you know, and they were actually juxtaposed against one another. So, you know, the queen would be smaller than the king, for example. But I mean, not smaller. I mean, smaller in scale. So, you know, you'd have these dichotomies of scale. And yeah, I mean, a big rabbit will scare the bejesus out of you. But a small rabbit, well, that's cute. But yeah, I get it. Scale really matters. I mean, I can tell you, Susan, I hate dolls. You know, the bigger the doll, the more scarier it is to me. I don't like big dolls, and, you know, big baby dolls are just frightening.
Yeah.
So I understand. So let's do, okay. So Dean, how about if we do one final shout out from you of how people can see the show, if it costs anything, where they should park, when they should come, if there's going to be something special going on, you tell us.
Sure. Come on down to the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum down here at the harbor. There's lots of parking at the harbor. The show is free with admission. You can go to our website, sbmm.org, for more information. And parents, if you have kids, huge hit with the little ones. I mean, not only will the parents be beguiled by the whimsy, but the kids in particular.
Yeah, I think the kids are probably going to be just loving this. And finally, Susan, one question that I have for you. So at the opening, you mentioned the opening and you mentioned folks reading the poems. Was there something that somebody said to you at the opening that was like kind of made you stop in your tracks and think about, wow, that's interesting? Was there one comment?
The woman wanting to be an avocado, that really did kind of stop me in my tracks. But I guess we have one that's... one of the things with the other stuff is I have a dye sublimated aluminum panel of, it's called Dangerous Chairs. And the number of people that were sort of lingering around there, it surprised me how some people didn't quite understand the concept, and other people, basically it's about 15 chairs that I did as a cyanotype solar prints.
And I saw that.
And then
yeah.
I put different things on the chairs. And some people didn't really notice the dangerous things. They were more looking at, well, why does she have four white chairs and the rest are all dark? And do you think that she arranged the chairs in a certain way? And those are all things that I hadn't really been thinking about myself, because I was thinking about, what is something dangerous that I can put on this chair? Like a shark, you know, and that's one of my favorites, is having a shark fin on the chair. Like if there's a shark up there, because you never would see a shark in a chair. So anyway, the idea that some people were taking it quite literally, trying to figure out like what was the artist thinking in terms of the layout and construction and not necessarily the content. So that was a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I think that's fascinating, because it's what people are doing is they're pattern seeking.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, they're looking for the pattern, and
right.
and you know, is the pattern the theme? Is the pattern the medium? Is a pattern? I mean, I thought that was brilliant, because the idea of the chair is that it's so solid that it supports your entire weight. If you were to sit down in a chair and it was dangerous and it exploded or fell over, it would be totally nonsensical to the idea of chairness. Anyway, so that's the thing, is that Susan's show will make you think and take a look at it at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, and you'll be surprised at how interesting it is to be inside a place that's devoted to Santa Barbara maritime history and has this really interesting sense of the medium itself being of importance. Not just, of course, obviously the artistic work is important too, but the idea that the medium is to be celebrated. And the medium is bronze. You know, that's a super interesting thing, I think, for me. Susan's work is described as both figurative and narrative, which you got to see it to believe it. So take a look at Susan's work. It's on, you have till the end of November. But take a little drive down to the harbor. It's beautiful. And as Dean Noble was saying, I can always find parking. I mean, so you can always find parking. And, you know, if you're a member, you can go and see Susan's show for free. And I encourage you also, membership is super important. I love that we actually, my partner and I actually get all sorts of happenings and lectures. There's always something going on at the Maritime Museum. There's always something really interesting that you didn't think about happening in terms of environmental concerns, for example, none the least of which. So anyway, thank you, Dean, for coming along and being with us. And Susan, it's been a delight. Susan Reed Cronin, the artist that we're celebrating in her show, Play, Bronze Sculptures and Other Stuff.
Thank you.
Thanks
so
a
much,
lot, guys.
Thank you,
Elizabeth. Thank you.